Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. On today's episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about Wandering Monsters, which is the where we get the title for the show, actually. So I'm kind of surprised, Paul, it's taken us this long to get around to
our been namesake. Been on the list for a long time, I think, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. What should we talk about today? Should you use Wandering Monsters? The answer to that is yes. How often should you roll for them, and how powerful should you make them? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
I was mentioning to Dan, back in the day, that the thing that spawned this very show was Dan and I going to conventions and having these crazy conversations. And I was like, this is totally one of those, right? This is one of those things where we probably are close, but kind of disagree a little bit, and we'll just, circle each other. And I'm predicting this is going to be a good one.
a small bit of sparring. Bit of sparring, yes. Good for that.
That's where we're likely to end
up. So Paul and I are both, classic D&D, players, and obviously Wandering Monsters was a, mechanic that's core, really very central to classic D&D, both original D&D and BX and stuff like that. And it's something that is less used in later editions. Let me ask Paul, do you know, like, in fifth edition, does there a core regular mechanic for wandering monsters in the dungeon, or is that not that
I'm aware of? Not that I'm aware of. No, I think it would be per adventure would indicate whether or not to roll for them. Now I'm trying to remember, like, how called out is that in the original text, or maybe in BX or something like that? I feel like it is, but I feel like every module then would warp the rules a little bit, right? They would always say, check this frequently, or roll these dice, or, It was a very commonly, I think, very commonly manipulated thing in old modules, I feel.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like, so original D&D has a core, rule for wandering monsters in the wilderness and wandering monsters in the dungeon. And I feel like, and I think I realized this kind of late in the game, that the core wandering dungeon monsters is really specific to the Greyhawk Castle environment. Right. So what you get there is really an expression specifically of what Gary did in his Greyhawk Castle. Castle Greyhawk dungeon wasn't specifically, phrased that way. It wasn't presented as here's what I do in Castle Greyhawk. It's just like, here's how you do monsters in the dungeon. And for whatever reason, it hadn't occurred to him at that point that there would be different environments in different dungeons. And so obviously it's something that makes sense. And you're right. There really ought to be tables tuned to the dungeon that you're in. But that actually wasn't explicated in the original rules.
I'll tell you what, this is the most common way I use wandering monsters these days myself. Is actually part of my sort of standard dungeon authoring toolkit. If I'm going to sit down and write a one-page dungeon, let's say, and I've got a map and I'm going to stock it, usually what I do is I sit down and I make a list of all the monsters that might appear in the dungeon. So I've got, usually I'm hoping for like 20, right? I want a list of 20 so I can roll it on a d20. Okay. And then stocking the dungeon, alternating between intentional choices and rolling on that table.
Gotcha.
And then when I'm done, I look at what's left on the table, and what's left on the table goes into the wandering monster chart.
Interesting. Are you talking multiple levels at once, or are you talking just one level at once?
One level at once. And this is, this is very much specifically like if I was doing a single. You know what? Let me go back. When I author dungeons, I typically don't make multi-level dungeons. Big mega dungeons are not really my forte on writing size. Usually, if I'm running a campaign, what I usually prefer is a large wilderness with many small dungeons scattered throughout.
Yeah. Okay.
So, multi-level is pretty uncommon for my writing style. Not to say I wouldn't run them, but usually if I'm running a multi-level dungeon, it's because I found another one somewhere printed that I like and I want to use it.
Gotcha. It's interesting because my understanding is that sort of like the Arnesonian style. The Arnesonian style is to emphasize the wilderness and a bunch of different places, and maybe the Gygaxian style was more the whole game's a dungeon.
Yeah.
And if you want anything else, go play outdoor survival.
I mean, certainly, and I will say, like, wilderness, I'm much more likely to use wandering monsters in wilderness than in a dungeon.
Yeah. Well, now on that point, I must, and thanks to John Peterson, so I was flipping through playing at the world here, because, of course, the wandering monster mechanic itself originally comes from outdoor survival. Mm-hmm. So can you trek through the wilderness board game from Avalon Hill, right? Is it?
Yep, Avalon Hill? I believe it. Yeah, it's Avalon Hill.
Okay, yeah. I'm looking at the so by Avalon Hill, of course, that is required, as we said multiple times, is required equipment when you're playing D&D and provides the background to our show. As a matter of fact, obviously, it's the background to outdoor survival. There's three main mechanics in outdoor survival, right? It's are you getting enough food and water? Mm-hmm. Are you getting lost? There's a die roll every day to see if you're lost. And then there's an optional roll for encounters. I'll take one of the mission cards from outdoor survival, and on the front, so here's the food issues here. Here is the direction ability. And if you roll low, you get lost. Notice rolling low there is worse. And then there's a completely optional thing in the rules on the back side of the card. There's possible encounters. Mm-hmm. Now, you only go to this table if you've decided to use the optional mechanic, and B, you roll high. So using this, there's an additional D6 roll each day. And if you roll a 5 or a 6, then you go to this table. And you notice that there's actually several different categories here. There's natural hazards, which is probably like weather type stuff. It's very abstract, right? The only effects here are, do you lose a turn? Do you lose some food, right? Do you maybe gain some food is kind of rare. So it's very, very abstract, but it seems like the main categories are like weathery type stuff, and then, you know, animal type stuff, and then just you were personally being stupid type stuff of like either tripping or setting your camp up wrong or something like that.
Interesting.
So it's interesting that the overall mechanics were entirely lifted from outdoor survival, right?
Yeah.
If you look in original D&D, the chance to be lost is rolling low, and the chance for a monster encounter is rolling high. And so they're totally, you know, they totally don't have a unified mechanic, precisely because he entirely just lifted the mechanic right out of outdoor survival. It's just that the only encounters now are just monsters, right? So there's no, in original D&D, there's no weather, there's no accidents, there's no quicksand, mm-hmm. they're just monsters. And so there are times when, like, I feel, you know, like that's a little bit too bad, actually, that I wish that the core D&D mechanic included those other environmental things like weather and accidents and stuff like that. But it's,
again, I feel like that's a thing you're going to find in the modules themselves. I think, like, I'm thinking of, like, you know, a lot of the X modules. I feel like certainly a lot of the X modules have sort of expanded random encounter tables that have all kinds of interesting weather stuff or whatnot.
Good point.
Right. Again, point. Maybe this is a case of why would you need a weather chart if you're in the dungeon?
Good point, but also wilderness, right? So actually, I'm thinking wilderness first, right? So the wilderness, you know, there's no lost table in dungeon, obviously. So even the wilderness, just monsters, right? Just lots and lots of monsters all over the world. Obviously, you're right. If you're focused on the dungeon, then even more reason to get rid of it.
Right. So you know, a little of this, you know, boils down to like how you're running your game and whether it's very procedurally generated and you're improvising a lot or you're, you know, pre-thinking out a lot of your content. And I know my style and probably, you know, a lot of people's style is some mix of those, right? Like not completely in one direction or the other, but some, you know, meld of the two inputs there. But I think that when we talk about wandering monsters and like why are they there, when you start to think sort of critically about them, why are they there and do you want them? It comes down to pacing. In my mind.
Yes. Yep. Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So then again, and I feel like a broken record on this one, but it's so different for me when we're talking about one-shots or convention games versus, you know, long-running campaigns. I feel like my opinion is going to change radically based on which of those two things we're talking about.
And again, it took me a long time to realize the difference. Now I agree with that. And as a tiny little bit of OCD, I read the text. The text says X. I do X. That's what it said. That's the text. That's the script. Having attempted to run a number of convention-style games using the rules, including Wandering Monsters, and realizing the pacing was all off, it finally got through my very thick skull that you have to distinguish between the two contexts. And nowadays, I just abort Wandering Monsters in a convention game. Is that basically what you're saying that you do?
Yep. 4 hours is just such a tight, short experience that you need more control, I think, over pacing. So probably not. You know, I might have the table there handy just in case, if I'm in that extreme of pacing of they're going too quickly and I need to slow them down. Right. But that's so unlikely. Much more often it's I need to cut. Because I want to get them through stuff faster so that they can have an experience that follows some kind of arc.
I'll touch back and then I have so many. Now I'm realizing we have so many things to say. Now I was worried.
I knew it was going this way. Go on.
I basically designed my dungeon pretty similar to what you said before, except I picked left fewer monsters, actually. It's like my current habit is per level. To pick like a half dozen, pick like six.
How big's a level? How many rooms?
40 rooms. 40.
Okay.
40 rooms.
It's pretty big.
It's 30 by 40 squares, which gives me approximately about 40 rooms ish.
I will say this: when I have my list of 20 monsters, when I put some of them in the level, and then use some of the leftovers to make the Wandering Monster table, there's usually some extras that don't make the cut at all.
Okay, interesting. So for me, I try to have it be the same. Like I try to place a lair for each of these half dozen monsters, and then that's also the Wandering Monster chart. And I'll say this: I make the Wandering Monster chart first. I mean, we're sort of saying the same thing. Is I actually go, what are the half dozen monsters I want on this level, and that the Wandering Monster chart actually comes first for me, and then I go and I actually design the layers of where their main stronghold is on the level.
So here's an interesting thing. Sometimes I struggle with how to interpret when I roll a Wandering Monster chart. Where did the monsters exactly come from, right? So you're saying you're tying them to specific layers, which is great. But the problem I have with that is there are some monsters where that makes perfect sense. Who knows how many giant centipedes are in the walls, right? Whereas when it's like, say you're in a goblin den, and you're like, okay, there's a goblin king, and he's got his personal guard, and there's 50 goblins or whatever. Right. Does that mean that you're a little looser on how many total goblins are in the place? Or when you roll in the Wandering Monster, are you deducting them from other locations?
Great question. I don't deduct them from other locations. I assume that there's wandering guard groups. Yeah. Or I'll have a barracks that is a third full. Here's a barracks and there's 30 beds. There's 10 goblins in the room. And without saying it, I just like what are the other 20 beds being used for? Well, all the other goblins are wandering around in guard groups on a regular schedule.
So in my Vile Crypt, the Reawakened Sisterhood, in the 5th edition version of that's available in DM's Guild, there are exactly 6 acolytes, and there is a wandering monster table, and one of the entries is an acolyte. And so I specifically say in there, it's either the one from this room or that room, and if those two are both dead, you're going to have to re-roll. It's something else. Or nothing.
The first time I saw a mechanic like that was in, one of your favorite modules, Secret of Bone Hill by Len Lakofka, right? Mm-hmm. He has, up in front, he has this full roster of every monster in the dungeon. And anytime you run into somebody, you're supposed to mark it off the roster.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really novel. That was the first time I'd ever seen that. Do you do that for every single monster, or is it just like big important name chiefs?
Well,
like that?
For me, it's the ones that actually have a lair where I know exactly how many things there are. Right. Okay. So I certainly have some monsters in my Wandering Monster chart, like I said, which don't tie back to anything in the dungeon, and they're literally wandering. Right. Like they have no home here. They just happen to come by. But when I do tie it to a specific thing that is layered in the dungeon, then yes, absolutely, I expect to knock it off. Because I don't know, I find it really weird if like if you went through and killed all the goblins in the goblin area, and then a little later we roll randomly and you find D6 goblins. What's going on? Where were those goblins before?
Well, that's a different that's a different direction of the implication arrow, Paul, I will point out. And I will say, and probably I shouldn't admit this to my players, but my mechanic is once you wipe out the lair, then I strike that item off the wandering monsters table.
There you go.
And so that if my players are listening, they'll recognize that there's been a number of times where I go, a level that you've been on before, I roll a wandering monster check, which is visible actually, which they see. I go, let's go see what it is. I roll another die. I check the table. I go, oh, I guess nothing shows up this time.
Now that's interesting.
They wiped out the lair, and therefore I strike it off the chart.
That's, I like the idea of rolling the wandering monster chart in front of players. I think that's interesting. I've never actually done that. So that begs the question. Oh, we're all over the map now. How often do you roll? How often do you check, Dan?
I have really struggled with this. I think this is a real issue. And obviously, the original book says every 10 minutes of game time. And I think I came to think that was too frequent. And so now I do every fifth. What I personally do is I do every 15 minutes of real time.
Yep.
Is I'm not tracking like you did this and that took a round and then you searched this room and that took two turns. I actually just have a watch on the table, and every 15 minutes, in real time, I make a D6 roll.
There was a time a while back where I was running with an actual little flip turn counter.
Right.
And this was when I was being very literal about running BX, so every turn was 10 minutes. And it was like, remember when your spells are cast, remember when you lit a torch, because you know this is the nut, when this number comes up, that's dead. And then I would do that for like wandering monster checks. I actually ran a game using that at Gen Con back in like 2008, and have a friend that I met there at the table that you know I'm still in touch with who freaking loved that. He thought like this is great. This is the way it's meant to be run. I've long since stopped doing it. Which is kind of funny. here's my problem with that. I think wandering monsters. Best thing about wandering monsters is their ability to control pacing. And I personally, especially when we're talking campaign play, I like to use Wandering Monster to solve what I call the Goldilocks problem.
Okay.
So some folks who've ever read my blog might know this, but I'll just reiterate it real quick. So the Goldilocks problem is this. I like my dungeons to have some level of realism or some sense of it them being a location and not like a level in a video game. Right, yeah. I really rebel strongly against the idea that a dungeon could be cleared. Right, yeah, okay, maybe you killed all the goblins in this den, but let's see. To bring it to that analogy of like it's a location, right? It's like a neighborhood, or it's like a house, right? If the cops run into a house and find a bunch of folks with a meth lab and they arrest them all and take them away, how long is that house going to remain empty? Not forever, right? Eventually, someone's going to buy it at auction, or house flippers will get their hands on it, or squatters show up. People are going to show up, right? That house is not going to remain empty.
Right.
So, Goldilocks' problem is this. We're in the dungeon, killed a bunch of monsters, still haven't seen everything. I, as DM, know exactly what's in the dungeon, and I know who's aware that the players are there and who isn't, and what defenses they're taking. And then the players decide, well, we are low on spells, low on health. We're going to lock ourselves in this room and sleep.
I hate that.
Right.
I hate that, and it's yet like, I know it's common, and it's even suggested at some point.
It happens all the time. Players, yeah, I'm just like, no, that's so crazy, right? Like, it's Goldilocks. I'm going to break into your house, and then I'm going to lock myself in your room, and I'm going to take a nap. Really? Well, guess what? I'm not going to – my monsters who are aware that you're here, they're not just going to wait for you to have your nap. They're going to come, right? So that's usually – that's when I like to get very literal, and I say, okay, well, every 10 minutes of game time, I'm supposed to make a wandering monster check. You're going to rest for 8 hours? Okay, 6 times 8 is 48. Let me make 48 checks right now.
What
do you know? Something's showing up.
Right. You know, there's a downside. I feel, this might have been many, many, many years ago, but I feel like I got in trouble trying to follow that policy, and among the trouble is that it's actually advantageous for the players to be on the defensive, is they would prefer to have the monsters having to bust down a door, have a choke point, have a defensible point, and they would actually prefer to be on that side and take a defensive stance as monsters come in and they just chew them up.
Well, find monsters that don't have to use the door, I guess, is my response to that. I definitely remember having a moment when a whole bunch of giant centipedes came crawling out of holes in the walls in the room that they were hiding in. It's like, well, you know, they're burrowers. Sorry, here they come.
Two approaches that I have is one to just announce that this will not be restful and your wizards cannot get their spells back in this situation. And then two, with my pretty darn close to original healing rule, right, that you need to be in town in a restful place for a whole week before you get any hit points back, that pretty much clinches it's not a good idea to sleep in the dungeon.
Yeah, I mean, that solves it for health, but does it solve it for spells, right? Surely somebody's going, oh, I need my spells back.
Yeah, and I just say it's not restful enough in a dungeon. That just doesn't work. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's reasonable.
So
reasonable
no hit points and no spells when you're in the dungeon. That usually clinches it for me.
Yeah, I definitely, it became a little game for me, honestly, until my players realized what I was doing and stopped, you know. Stopped. Also, read my blog and like saw me rail against the golden block syndrome. And then we're like, okay, let's maybe not do that anymore.
Right.
You know, like a little game of like, okay, what wandering monster shows up? Okay, so it's, you know, group of orcs and the players are in this room with the door locked. What are they going to do? They might try to bang down the door the first time. Maybe the second time, now they're going to, maybe we should lay some traps, you know? And then I'll just screw with the players. Oh, you hear something going on out there. Just hammering. You hear hammering. What? What's
happening? There's some sort of motor noise in the background.
You're not sure. Players can't take that. They're going to go investigate.
Fine.
It's like a fog. What's happening? Oh, it's great. I totally envision that scene from Holy Grail, right? Where the Frenchmen are up on the ramparts and you hear all the woodworking noises.
Right,
they're like,
right. That's totally what I'm.
You're not fooling anyone, guys.
I'm right now myself. You're right. Yeah, you're right.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, for me, I do try to have those things very mechanical and very objective in because I don't trust myself to be fair or unfair. So I do attempt, right? I do attempt to have these things on rails and on dice, and the dice are being shown to the players, and I tell them what the chances of an encounter showing up. I know that many times, Paul, you take more of a free hand in manually adjusting for pacing purposes, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many other factors that play into pacing, right? Factors that have nothing to do with the game, right? Like how many sessions are we going to get to play? Who's up visiting my house for once in a blue moon?
Yeah.
And I want to make sure that person has a good time, right? Like, it gets tough, and then I just don't want the dice to drag my game down.
Yeah, for me, my game world is a terrible place. It's been said many times that it's a terrible time to be alive in my game world. It's the dice provide an opportunity for it to turn into a horror story at any moment. And that's part of what you're dealing with is an uncaring Lovecraftian universe that is willing to not notice that it's chewing you up from time to time. And you have to find a way to try to deal with that.
I mean, this is approaching our metagaming conversation, right? Where I love the idea of having something in the game where the players are doing something tedious and are bored. But the last thing in the world I want to do is to actually bore my players who are sitting around the table.
Yeah.
Being bored. I don't want them to be actually bored. Right.
No, I don't want them to be role playing me, but you might actually have to role playing being horrified.
Yeah, sure.
You might have to role play being terrified based on your existence being predicated on completely random die rolls that's out of your control at this point. That you might actually have to do at my table. So sorry. but that's part of what's going to happen there. So the wander. I feel like the wandering monsters are for me an important part of that. Is the threat could be more than you assumed, or it could be less than you assumed on a particular night.
Again, I really like having them there, and I like any adventure that tells me there's a wandering monster chart.
Yeah,
and I consider it, you know, my job as DM to know when to roll on it and when to ignore it.
Okay. Okay.
And that's going to change for me moment to moment.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. For me, it's on a hard clock. For me, it's on a literal timer.
Now, I like that as a tension building device, especially when you're talking about rolling the rolls out in the open. I think that's really nice as a tension builder. I'm thinking now of like, what's the Lamentations of the Flame Princess module? Just ran it myself not too long ago. Anyway, the point being, it begins...
Death Frost Doom.
That's exactly the one. You got it. Yep. So it begins with cracking open the door to this tomb. And then I think there's like some stuff that's frozen up in the air and it starts to defrost and big blocks are dropping. And basically it tells you right in the beginning of the module, they're like, this is a tension building pacing mechanic, right? That this is going to happen every 10 minutes of real time. So every 10 minutes, you know, you have to have a timer in front of you.
Right.
And every 10 minutes of real time that pass, describe a loud crash and the, you know, things dropping and falling because this, you know, the whole place is about to defrost and collapse.
Right. I agree.
Brilliant. It lands with every play group I've played with. With every play group I've played with, they've immediately realized, oh no, we have to hurry. Something terrible is happening.
Right. I really feel like those real time things are, again, you know, challenging players. They're very concrete. They're again, clearly not at the whim of the DM. So, I mean, I feel like the first time I ever saw that was actually in Tomb of Horrors. There's a couple of places where a trap goes off. And the DM is supposed to count to 10 or something, like count to 5, right? 5, 4, 3. So I actually use that a number of times in my games, and having the wandering monsters on a regular schedule and having the ongoing trap in Death Frost Doom on a regular schedule, I agree, I think really makes it concrete and visceral, and I think is a good... really, it seems to work better than checking off 10-minute increments on a piece of graph paper.
Yeah, I like it slows me down.
It's not visible to the players, and I prefer to have it be kind of more concrete.
Yeah, I think that sounds really nice as a again, if you can solve the Goldilocks problem some other way, which it sounds like you have between the healing rules and between just saying you can't memorize spells anywhere but your nice comfy study at home, then I think that's great. You know, but I mean, I'll point back to almost a year ago when we did our my birthday game, right? Eventually you guys delved down to a point where you found the rat prince's lair and you made friends with him and he let you sleep there. So I feel like,
right?
Every rule must have a case that breaks it. What is it? There's a phrase for that. Okay. Brain's not working anymore.
Well, there's the Bronstinian, anything can happen principle, which anything should be on the table to possibly break rules. And then there's the Joel Spolsky all abstractions are leaky principle, which kind of dancing around. Not exactly the same thing, but
And
that was a great piece of business. That's a great piece of business. You know what? You know, I was actually, you know, I wouldn't have designed it. And yeah, I was so happy to have this ridiculous opportunity for negotiation. And then there was like a duel, and then there was like gambling with the rat prince deep in the dungeon, and then have actually a semi, you know, secure base for further expeditions was so great. It was such a great piece of business.
You know, back over Memorial Day, I hosted a panel on part of Con of Champions. Apologies here. The lawnmower guy is going right by my window right now, so I'm sure you'll hear that. Sorry, everyone. I hosted a panel on creating custom monsters. And just as an icebreaker, I asked everybody to introduce themselves and tell me what their favorite classic D&D monster was.
Brilliant.
And, you know, I had already introduced myself as the moderator, and I forgot to answer it myself. And my favorite monster, if I had to go to one specific thing, is probably a lich. But any monster specifically who is smart enough to talk to the players and crazy enough to want to do so. Right. That's what I love about a lich, right? A lich is, you know, can have a conversation with the players and, you know, and is unhinged, is willing, like, that. Who knows what direction? I've had so many good encounters with liches where I remember I had one where basically I had one player in the party save the whole rest of the party by saying, I will stay here with you and help you solve this impossible to solve, you know, arcane problem. I will become your student, and don't worry about these people, they're just going to leave. And I was like, and that's how that adventure ended, with this guy you know, sacrificing himself to lichdom. I was like, oh, it's so good. Oh, so good.
Brilliant.
Sorry, that was such a tangent. How did I get talking to monsters? I love monsters who talk. That's my point. I want monsters who the players can talk to.
And even if it breaks the you can't sleep in the dungeon principle, which is the standard rule, right.
Where we get to the rat prince, the rat prince.
They are great pieces of business. When that happens, when it happens for me, it tends to be like semi-accidental when that pops up, and I'm like, oh, well, this is a wonderful little refreshing surprise.
I definitely, when we were running that, I did not, and like I was hoping that you would get to talk to the rat prince. I had no idea how it was going to end. The fact that it went to some weird duel was fantastic, and then I was like, all right, it's reasonable that the party, I guess, would befriend him, and then of course set us up for the lovely ending with the rat prince, which I will not spoil.
You know, it's nice to have it's nice to have factions in a big dungeon, and then there's play about can we play one against the other, and can we ally ourselves with one, and or, be a double agent or something like that. Those are, and having a dungeon that's big enough to have multiple competing parties in it is actually opens up a whole lot of extra possibilities.
I agree. I don't think you need a dungeon to do that, right? I think, again, with your many small dungeons in a wilderness, you can still have factions. They just become locations on the hex map instead of locations in the dungeon.
Yeah. I think in a dungeon, I mean, they're at least close to being right on top of each other. So there's like additional immediate friction, right?
That's
immediate,
true.
Like we're running into each other automatically on a daily basis and contending or something like that. So there's kind of this like piling on top of each other. There's immediate extra tension as a result.
Yeah.
So I do kind of like that.
So let me bring us back to our discussion about wandering monsters. So we've talked a lot about them in the dungeon. So what about the wilderness? We both agree we like to use them in the wilderness. How often are you rolling for wandering monsters in the wilderness?
It's funny because I think that you expect, Paul, that I have a pat answer to this because I've run, I've done the outdoor survival, or what I call outdoor spoliation, with D&D games a number of times. And I, over time, I've become more and more murky about what I should be doing.
That's funny.
And, so obviously, I think in original D&D, the main mechanic, the primary mechanic, is wandering monsters in the wilderness.
Yeah.
When they say go to outdoor survival, they actually don't say make lairs. It's just like, here, there's some castles run by people. And other than that, go to the wandering monster table. There's wandering monsters. And then, of course, there's a core statistic for original D&D monsters. It's the percent in lair. And so you're going around the wilderness, you run into wandering monsters, and then you roll, when one pops up, you roll percentile dice to find out whether this was actually in a lair or not.
Right.
And that's the only way, that's the only core way that monsters appear in the wilderness in original D&D, and that sort of became vestigial over time. And so the problem is, like, I think along about last October or so, I got access to Dave Arneson's first fantasy campaign product, and in that, he really kind of takes that mechanic to task. He actually says, wandering monsters can show up in large numbers and really ruin your day. And he attempts to present a totally different mechanic in which he, I think, pre-rolls in every single hex on the map for what monster is there, to the tune of like maybe 4 to 6 monsters per 10-mile hex in your entire campaign map, and then you're committed to, on a seasonal basis, making rolls in every single monster in every single hex, how many people get born and how many people die, and whether they migrate one hex over, and then the DM has to roll a fight with the next lair over, and then as players move around the board, you have to roll for whether the wandering monster is coming from this hex or one adjacent. And then, and I'm like, how, I mean, this has to be aspirational. There is no way on earth that anybody ever took the time to do this for every hex and have a complete master list. And I've seen people online claim that, oh, Arneson was just smart enough, he just would memorize all that stuff. And I'm like, I'm really super skeptical about it. So honestly, I've been struggling for a couple of months.
Sounds like so much homework. Oh, so much homework.
Yeah.
No thanks.
And I've tried to find a halfway point. So the half, and so, okay, so for me, using the, like, even using the original D&D rule, like, here's my problem. Right. You're moving around the wilderness. I roll for wandering monster. I roll for the in lair check. Well, now I have to document that. Right. Now I have an ongoing list in every single hex of all these lairs that I got to track. And I got to look that up. Has a lair been previously rolled up in this hex? Cause now I guess I have to handle that. And is there only one lair per hex, or can there be more? And, so it kind of becomes an ongoing, documentation problem. If I, once upon a time, I was really high on that. It's like, oh, you're developing the wilderness layers on the fly as you play. But I did that a little bit. I'm like, oh crap, now I have an ongoing documentation problem if I'm recording more and more stuff, and I have to remember or keep a list about every single hex the players travel through multiple times, whether there's a lair there or not. And so actually right at the moment, you know, so for a couple of months, I've actually kind of been in a real, mystery zone about what is the best mechanic.
I just want to point out, it delights me to no end that you are breaking the hearts. Oh no! Why did that appear giant on our screen? That's not what was supposed to happen.
Wow! I am attacked. Look at
what is going on? Something what is. How do I get rid of it now?
I hope I'm not.
Oh my god. Sorry everyone. That was supposed to show up in the little pop-up.
oh, and it's god. Twice. It's proliferating. Has that been there the whole time? Because there's a second one down here. Oh man.
I don't
Someone know. Really wanted to burn me on that. Oh. Well done.
Okay. Okay. Well done. I can
Now god. while Paul's
I was just amused that somebody was as horrified as I am that you don't follow exactly the precise rules.
But oh boy, this person on top of this is pointing to the Wilderness Survival Guide. That's an AD&D supplement there. And I don't know if you've seen that, but I tried to use the Wilderness Survival Guide in my college game, and it alone destroyed my game.
Okay. Wow, it is just really weirdly.
No,
I can't seem to make it go wrong. Bear with me, everyone. Bear with me. It's changed your... I see what's happened. It's changed your title. It's changed your title from Dan Collins to...
Wow. That's a nice hack, whoever managed to accomplish that. I'm super impressed.
Okay, I found it. Wow. I see.
We should put in quote like a middle. I don't know if it's a summer pay if Dan doesn't follow the WSP calls.
Okay, so I know exactly what Howie. Happened. So that's funny. Okay. Oh my goodness.
So specifically on the Wilderness Survival Guide, on the AD&D Wilderness Survival Guide, I tried, you know, and the funny thing is because that's by Doug Niles, right? Isn't the WSG by Doug Niles? And the,
you're asking me as if I might know that. There's no way I know that.
Let me just look that up. And the funny thing, you know, Doug Niles runs Hot and Cold for me. I'm going to see it in just a second here. No, it's Kim Mohan, right? Okay, that makes more sense. So Doug Niles wrote the Dungeoneer Survival Guide, which is actually fairly solid to me. And then Kim Mohan wrote the Wilderness Survival Guide, and I tried to use that religiously in my college game. And like an idiot, I allowed it to destroy my game because it's got weather rules that are so enormously complicated that I just, like, my whole game was actually just trying to handle that, and it was awful, and I felt terrible about it.
I understand the desire for weather rules. I like, honestly, having them, like you were mentioning earlier, boiled down into your random encounter. Random encounter doesn't have to mean monster for me, right? I like a random encounter table that's got you know, weather events, it's got monsters, it's got friendly NPCs in it, right? Like, all kinds of stuff. I actually really, so for my wilderness games, when I'm running a campaign, and like I said, I like to run it generally in the big wilderness with many dungeons scattered about, that means my players are often trekking from one place to another across a wilderness map. And I do expect them to draw their own wilderness maps. I don't give it to them. So either get out the hex paper and draw along with me, or draw just a representational map. And it's fun because I think that that means sometimes they find, oh, here's an alternate way to get from point A to point B, and they start coming up with different routes to take.
Right.
I use good old Rich Berlew's tongue-in-cheek method of I roll once per day. Once per day.
Yeah.
I don't care how fast you're moving or how much land you're traveling across. Once per day, I roll a wandering monster or wandering encounter check. And this is a case where I actually really love the tables right back in the back of Volume 3. Just give me a chance for wandering monster to appear based on terrain type. And then a nice table of, like, really just, you know, not too many, but a very wide range of things that might be in that, that terrain type. I think it's really nice too, like, because there's some stuff, like, if you're on a road, the chances are very high that you meet, you know, humans. And then I love that. I'm like, great, it's just someone else on the road, right? It's doesn't have it, this can be a random, you know, meeting up with NPCs or other travelers, and maybe that's beneficial, or maybe it's bad. Who knows? Maybe there are thieves out to get you. We'll find out through play.
Right.
Let's go.
I'll tell you a thing. So, you know, like, original D&D doesn't have, again, original D&D is set up for the outdoor survival map of, like, an expanse of just wilderness, and there's actually no roads, and just horrible monsters everywhere. And so one thing that I've done to tweak in my campaign is, A, I actually do, I actually did give the players a campaign map, you know, kind of in the sense of outdoor survival, so that they can make decisions about how to get from A to B. You want to go directly over the mountains, or you want to go through the woods around the mountains instead? And they're debating, you know, they have awareness and knowledge about what kind of choice they're making there. And original D&D doesn't have road encounters. So what I do is I was actually adding an additional die of, you'd have the normal monster encounter die. And specifically, if you're on a road, the lost die goes away, but it gets replaced by a roll for somebody else on the road.
Interesting.
And as a result, what's happened a couple times is I've gotten both the monster die coming up, and the other traveler die coming up, simultaneously. And so I've had the players run into a bunch of merchants being attacked by monsters.
Nice. Oh, that's great.
They've had to make a decision about, do we just bypass this and let it go? Do we get involved? Which side do we get involved in, right?
Yeah,
a couple of times and then it turned into like a giant mass battle, actually, of, you know, 100 merchant guards and 120 orcs, and the players made, you know, attacked the leaders and made the difference. And then the merchants gave my players a reward based on random dice, which was the biggest reward they've ever gotten. And they were like, well, we should just wander around the road saving merchants, because this is by far the most profitable thing that's ever happened to us in Dan's game. So I guess we should just be wandering vigilantes on the road now. And I was like, oops. Like, I hadn't thought through this could happen simultaneously, and I hadn't thought through how am I going to handle it, and I hadn't thought through, like, what are the merchants going to react at the end, and then I accidentally kind of gave away too much stuff, but that was an interesting piece of business the way I did that.
That's funny.
Yeah,
that's great.
One point I want to touch back on. So you said you want a set of wandering monster tables that are reasonable in size, right? Not too large.
Yeah.
And I feel like with the tables in original D&D, which, again, I didn't start playing until, you know, much later in life, about 12 years ago now or something like that, they're the right size, right? Both the dungeon tables and the wilderness tables are like maybe six, eight, 10 things per table. And it's in the right ballpark of the 7 ± 2 psychology, short-term memory type of thing. I can feel the flavor of it. Seems reasonable. And again, it's tuned to the Greyhawk Castle environment, or it's tuned to the, you know, Greyhawk outdoor survival map. And I feel like Gary made a mistake later on, is when he switched to AD&D and the monster list starts expanding and there's more supplements and there's more monsters, right? he tried in with AD&D, he tried to pile every single monster in the game into these dungeon tables.
And here's my take on that. I like a large variety of monsters. I like there to be tons of different crazy monsters in the world. But I think once you go that road, it behooves you to start whittling down tables based on context, right? I want to know, well, this area of the world is got a lot of, you know, fae in it. So I'm going to have fairies and sprites and trolls and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to have a custom wandering monster chart for here versus over there where it's mountainous and, you know, I want rocks and griffins and stuff like that.
Totally agree.
I think when you're making that kind of table, I think you should be looking at the actual physical dice you're going to roll. And you probably don't want anything bigger than a D20. The moment you've gone to percentile, your table's too big.
Totally agreed. Even D20, for me,
D20 is maybe a little too big. Yeah.
If it's 1 through 6, if it's 2 through 12, that I don't think I want to get past 2 through 12. I'm suddenly irritated. Like, I want the players to recognize it, right? I want them to go into a place and come away and go, geez, that place is really bad. There's a bunch of fire resistant trolls or whatever, right? And then when they go in the, you know, so they're warning people about it. That's the thing on their mind. When they go in the next time, there's at least a semi good chance that they're going to run into the fire resistant trolls and say, well, we knew about this and we were prepared and we brought a bunch of cold attacks or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it pays off because of our knowledge. And if it's so large that they never encounter the same thing twice, then it doesn't feel like a good payoff to me.
I agree.
And so I feel like the AD&D Monster Manual 2, Gary started to go in that direction of like, here's big lists. Of monsters by terrain, we recommend, and weirdly, he's got this mechanic of roll a D8 plus D12, like make tables with D8 plus D12, and then, you know, rare monsters on the ends and common monsters in the middle.
You know, that reminds me a lot of when we were playing the B Solo adventure, which had one wandering monster chart numbered 1 through 20, but then it had all these different rules based on what kind of dice with what kind of bonus you roll through which level you're on, right? On this level, roll 1d6. On this level, roll 1d8 plus 4, right? And it was just shifting where on the table you were. And I was like, couldn't you have just printed multiple tables, though? Really?
Well, it prevents having to repeat stuff, right? If they wanted, you know, stuff repeated on the multiple levels, it is a clever way of avoiding repetitions, I suppose.
I found it annoying to have to keep going. Yeah, like, really? What is the math? Okay, this one's D12. Right. What?
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right. I get it. I can see both. and looking at the table, it's not immediately obvious like what stuff shows up on what levels.
Right. Right. It's a little harder to read. Yeah.
Right. Right. That makes sense. So I wish that had been foreseen in the original books, because neither OD&D or BX or AD&D explicitly say, you know, you need to tune the wandering monster charts specific to the context of your dungeons. Kind of obvious, but there isn't a mechanic there to help you decide on frequencies or commonality or anything like that. It's just a giant table with, and obviously if in AD&D you're rolling percentile dice and there's a giant table with monsters of anything in the game can show up on any particular level, that actually becomes, that's the place where when people complain about wandering monsters not making sense, I agree. It's like just anything in the entire universe could be wandering through this particular 50-foot stretch of corridor on a particular daily basis. I agree.
Yeah.
That's hard to explain.
Well, and with a large variety of monsters, if you do bother to make your own tables, it does let you thematically push ideas in your campaign world. Like, I remember when I was running my long-running campaign, I had an area called the Gloomwood, which was specifically a kind of spooky woods that was always dark and there was, you know, supposed to be haunted and et cetera. And so I wrote a special table for it that was all full of undead and lycanthropes and stuff that is spooky, right? And it just really helped, right? Anytime you went in there, you were like, yep, we're definitely going to be facing these kinds of things. I think that's nice.
So I will say that, that's totally what you want. I mean, that's absolutely what you want. And I will say that, you know, so for me, at least in my dungeons, the wandering monsters are 5 times out of 6 tied to some lair, right? So at some point, if you find the right place, you're probably going to find the central stronghold headquarters of this group, and maybe they'll have a leader, and they'll have, you know, a living situation and explain why they're, you know, moving around, stuff like that. In other places, like maybe more wilderness stuff, right, the context of the environment is actually communicated via the wandering monster tables. Mm-hmm. Right? The wandering monster tables are actually informing you and the players what this place is like and what the, you know, what the demographics and the ecosystem is what I'm looking for. The ecosystem is like. And so when we switch to running a convention game, Paul, and we wipe out the wandering monsters, occasionally that's a big loss because that whole environmental information communication gets ripped out. And I'll say at the time that really hurt me was when I was running the Descent into the Depths series, the D1, D2, mm-hmm. D3 original Drow series. Most of the interesting, like, what's the underworld like, is being delivered on the wandering monster tables. And there's all kinds of, like, well, you know, dark elf merchants and, you know, gnomes and the mind flayers that can show up and interact with them, and, you know, weird extra dimensional demons and ghoul, you know, big groups of ghouls and, you know, Zorn types of creatures that don't appear in any of the set locations of those modules. And so for me, it was actually a real challenge. Like, I was wrestling, like, do I strip out the wandering monsters for the convention game? Because that's actually where all the interesting, you know, what's the crazy underworld like gets communicated. But you don't have time for all that.
You don't have time. That's the problem, right? Is you, if you're running it as a convention game, you've got 4 hours. Yeah. You have to carefully, you know, collate what's going to be in the... I mean, I totally agree with you. If you're running it just for your home group and you've got arbitrary number of sessions in which to do it, great. Roll on them tables, man. Go for it.
It's kind of the right choice. Hard for me to digest. It was hard for me to digest. I said, look, the convention, it's a different thing. Yeah. It's you're going to hit the high points. You're going to hit the tent poles. This is what you're delivering. These set encounters. It's a different game. And I had to digest it. And it was hard for me to get over that hurdle, but you're totally right.
You know, and the interesting thing I'll point out is it seems to me like, you know, we've covered how, like, Wandering Monsters has always been a little vague, I guess. Like, early editions of the game, it was constantly being tuned, right? It was constantly changed in all the modules and whatnot. It was under constant revision. It never really felt very explicitly laid out, here's how wandering monsters work. And then as later editions come along, it just vanishes entirely. And I'm having really a lot of trouble thinking of other games, not D&D, that have a wandering monster rule in them. And I almost feel like, here's my crazy theory, that maybe it comes out of the fact that in the early days of the hobby, there just wasn't a lot of content. So you needed procedural systems to generate the content. And now there's so much content that we expect, you know, this sort of pre-written, pre-thought out content to take place of all that. And we don't need, in theory, don't need procedural generation anymore.
That's a great thesis. That's a really strong thesis. That's probably smart. I mean, assuming you want to use other people's stuff, I will say that, you know, as someone trying to write my own campaign and maybe unwisely trying to not use other people's stuff when I do that, that's a lot of space to fill. And I don't want to write, you know, I don't want to spend time writing the adventures as verbosely as you get in published stuff.
Yeah.
And having systems that can generate stuff for my campaign world on the fly, assuming I don't want to use other people's stuff, assuming I don't have an infinite amount of time, then it was still an important mechanic for me to populate my world. But it's a really strong point that there's an enormous amount of content out there, and maybe you can get away without it. That's a strong thesis,
right? It's interesting. Yeah. I feel like it's almost like just you're treating your audience differently, right? It's a question of, are you presenting them with the things they need to build their own adventures, or are you just presenting them with adventures, right? Are you teaching a man to fish, or are you providing him with fish?
Great point. Super great point.
I know we're running out of time, but I feel like it's a little bit of a shame that we didn't talk about module B1. Right? B1 is isn't that the module which is totally unstocked and is you're meant to like stock on the fly as you go?
That tends to get that's a little bit of hyperbole. You're basically it's a little bit of hyperbole. So obviously B1 might car, you know, the locations have stuff is the thing. The locations have stuff and sometimes really super long detailed stuff, places and equipment and things and puzzles and traps and doors and transporters and all kinds of stuff. The one thing that's not placed there are where the monsters are, where the monsters are with specific treasures. And you're right, the DM is supposed to go through and place it. I think that, let me see, B1 is like that. The original B3 is like that. Merle Rasmussen's first module to Top Secret is like that.
Interesting.
So there was a phase with these introductory adventures at one point where they thought that's what they were doing all the time. I think as a transition point from a completely pre-made module versus a completely, you know, DM from scratch module. So they were trying to give this middle ground, I think, of like training you how to make a dungeon.
Right, right. But it's really only training you on that one detail of how to put the monsters in, right? Like all the hard stuff of how to have a theme and how to, you know, how to put those intentional encounters and how to write clever traps. Yeah. That's all missing. Like, we'll just let you do the grunt work of roll on tables and put monsters in place.
Well, it's not rolling. They're not made to be rolled on. You're supposed to select them intelligently.
Interesting.
Yeah, they're not. The tables aren't of a length of any particular die. They're actually labeled with Roman numerals. So no, you're not. That's not a roly thing. You're supposed to pick and choose intelligently where you're putting stuff.
Admittedly, I own some copies of B1. I've never sat down and read it back cover to cover. I've played it enough times for me to go, I don't need this adventure.
Okay. Some people love it. Some people love B1 due to the flavor. I have a post on my blog of like, is B1 too detailed to be a good example for new DMs making it? Is it just have like too much, you know, flavory type stuff to intimidate starting DMs? And I've had people really, really kick back against any kind of complaint against B1 because some people really, really love it. It has a lot of imaginative stuff. I mean, it has a lot of imaginative stuff in it. So I totally understand why. The pool room's great.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm sure there are good details. Again, like I guess I've just had enough opportunities to play through it as a player where the aspect of it as a teaching guide or whatever, that part of it, I don't need that. And
so your experience as a player has been what made you not happy about it?
Well, for one, the ridiculous twisting, impossible to map corridors with their diagonals and corkscrews and stuff like that is super annoying. And then two, like, you know, the non-placed, I mean, we had a friend who would run it like by actually rolling dice on random tables on the fly.
That
made it very shaky, right? It's sort of, you know. Sometimes it was good and sometimes it was bad. And I was like,
I see.
Anyway, I'm judging a thing based on having only played it and never actually sat down and read the whole thing. So it's really poor stance for me to be judging anything from. So
it's a very old, it's a very old school thing that the whole like tangled, hard to map corridors. I mean, according to original players with Gygax, that was the game. The whole game was,
like, I understand,
hard map dungeons with occasional monsters. So, I mean, that comes through and I'm not defending it, but I see where that came from. And the other thing is it's mostly empty of monsters actually. Right. So when original D&D says the vast majority of your dungeons will have no monsters, B1 does that. And so it's actually the problem that I've had is that I've had a player play B1. Actually, it was Disinvited Artists Vulgar Running. So I've had a player play B1. Right, that has a fairly small number of monsters, right? And then take those characters, switch to B2, where Gary has about five times as much monsters. I wasn't immediately cognizant of that fact and just immediately get massacred in B2.
Yeah.
Right, with the same characters that were successful in V1. So that you have to be careful about how few monsters there are in V1 is the main thing that I'm aware of now.
All right, I have drawn us off into a crazy tangent, especially one that I am ill-informed to speak on, and we're almost out of time. So,
one last thing. Speaking of final time, thoughts. Paul.
Yeah.
I guess before I go to the final thoughts, so there was a brief time, speaking of time and keeping track of time, there was a brief time between your flippy turn marker and I think what you do now, where you used an actual sand timer on the table.
Yeah, I did try.
Did you do that anymore, or is that not that?
No, I did not. And the problem with it is simply this. I was trying to time the entire duration of the... I wanted a four-hour timer. Couldn't find a sand glass that was a full 4 hours, so I had one that was just like 1 hour. And then I tried to get clever with it about like what happens at the end of hours.
The problem is...
It was yet one more thing for me to manage as DM, and I would forget about it. And then I'd look and go, oh, it's empty. How long has it been sitting there empty for?
Right. And then there was a time where you tried to pass it over to the players. You passed it over to the player's side and said, you watch this and tell me when it's over.
Yep. Which is nice, but the players need some positive incentive to do that. They need a carrot or they're not going to...
I liked it being on the table. The first time I saw it, I was like, great. And then the other problem you'd run into is like if you need to jump forward in time, right? You go, oh, we're going to jump forward 3 hours. We need to reset the sand timer. And then we're like shaky, trying to forcibly reshake it, you know, halfway through was the problem. So we got locked into not being able to jump time when you wanted to.
I feel like I was using it when I was trying to. The one time I remember using it was when I was running sort of like, let me teach brand new players who've never played how to play D&D. And I was trying to reinforce that we literally only had 4 hours. I remember playing with this one younger player who was just flabbergasted when I flipped the thing. And I said, okay, I'm going to do this, you know, three more times or two more times or whatever it was. And he said, well, what happens then? What happens when that runs out? And I said, the game's over. And he was like... So I couldn't believe that we would end. The game would just end. Like, well, it's got to end. I can't stay here forever, my man.
I had a student once who got to the final exam, which is coming up in another week, actually. So years ago, got the final exam, and they were like, and then they asked, and what do we do after the final? And I said,
go home, well, live your life.
Nothing. Yeah, it's final. At that point, it's the class is final, and we're done. And they said, oh, well, I'm very sad about that because I've really been enjoying these meetings that we've been having. So I don't know, you know, I don't know what situation had come in before. They were unaware of what happened at the end of a semester. But that reminds me of your player not cognizant that things end.
It ends, man. It ends. We got to.
Unfortunately.
Sorry.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. All right. So, Dan, final thoughts on Wandering Monsters.
I mean, for the old school games that we play and I play, I mean, they're really a fundamental core part. They've been there since outdoor survival. That's where it comes from. They're sort of the main balancing technique over your spells per day, kind of, you know, what people call 20-minute adventuring day problem. They give you a lot of context, right? They give you a lot of context to what the environment you're in is like. It's a very concise way of communicating that. You do want them to be connected and hooked into your lairs and what the environment is. You don't want it literally just be random anything. And I do think that was a little bit of an oversight in the original rules not to explicate your wandering monsters are things in your location, tie them into that. And I think that failing to explicate that is maybe where they get a little bit of a bad rap.
Yeah. I mean, for me, they're a great tool to have in the toolbox. I think you need to know how to use them intelligently, which means you have to question why are they here? What purpose are they serving?
Yeah.
Make sure you know the answers for that in your game, and then you'll know how to use them effectively and when to just decide to pass.
I think the list, I mean, the list should be curated. And for me, I like to be surprised. So I will have a pretty hardcore mechanic that I'm rolling on because I don't trust myself to adjudicate what a crazy chaotic world is like. But the list should be curated very intelligently, and you should be aware about why these things are in this location.
Yeah, 100% agree with that.
Yeah.
All right.
Definitely.
kind viewers, it's time for us to wrap up. If you have any thoughts on when to roll for wandering monsters, how to roll for wandering monsters, whether you should roll for wandering monsters, please leave us some comments here in the video chat. We would love to hear from you. We will respond, and we will possibly spin out whole new shows based on your thoughts. So please tell us what you think.
Definitely. Definitely. And how many DMs show up when they show up on their wandering monster check? So remember viewers that you can like and follow and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and also Facebook by the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites.
You can also find audio-only podcast versions of our show. Those are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Or you can download them from the variety of podcast carriers, such as iTunes and Google Podcast. If you are listening to us on one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us. We really appreciate that.
We definitely do. And thanks again to our patrons who support the Wandering DMs show. If you would like to join them, and we hope that you will, if you have some extra resources at the moment, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Next week, Paul, we're going to have a guest lined up, scheduled, Mr. Landon Schertz, who is a professor of philosophy and works in the areas of aesthetics and philosophy of games and pop culture. And he's written some notable papers on superheroes and the ethics of Batman and philosophy of games and things like that that he's shown at conferences. And so personally, I'm really looking forward to speaking with Landon Schertz next week on the philosophy of games and role-playing games like D&D. Excellent. So please join us. We hope that our viewers will join us for that. Look for other shows throughout the week. We'll let you look at the normal schedule that's coming up this week. Please do connect to us on social media sites, and then you'll know about what other shows we have. Remember, of course, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time for our flagship talk show right here. So please join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.